Welcome to the latest global news, recorded at 15 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 14th of April. I'm James Menendez with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service News Today. Coming up, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured in an earthquake in a remote area of western China. Most of the buildings in one town have collapsed. This charity worker is in the region.
We've been hearing of hundreds dead, confusion, panic, thousands injured, a complete devastation of a town.
Also in the podcast, we'll hear from Kyrgyzstan, where the ousted president is losing international support but still refusing to step down. He says he's ready to negotiate.
So far, they haven't contacted me, none of them. They are waiting, but what are they waiting for?
There's a row in Poland over the decision to bury President Lech Kaczynski in a place traditionally reserved for kings and heroes. And
this, for me, what I'm looking out at now is farmland as far as the eye can see in all directions. It used to be highly intensive, mechanised, farmed land. None of it now is being used.
Our reporter travels to Zimbabwe to meet the winners of the country's controversial land reform programme. But first, China says at least 400 people have died and 10,000 others have been injured in an earthquake in the mountainous province of Qinghai near the Tibetan border. The quake, with a magnitude of 6.9, flattened houses, schools and offices and cut water and power supplies. A Chinese official in the town of Jiegu said 80% of the buildings had collapsed there. Emergency teams have been racing to drain a reservoir that's developed a crack. Damaged roads have made it difficult to move in heavy equipment. But the local airport has opened and specialist rescue teams have begun to arrive. Robin Lustig spoke to Diana Dodd, who works with the charity ROCPA, which operates in the town of Yushu, close to the epicentre. She's been in touch with people there in the hours since the quake struck.
We've been hearing of hundreds dead, confusion, panic, thousands injured. A complete devastation of a whole town.
You've been to the town, haven't you?
Many times, yes.
Describe it for us.
It's about two big major streets and two rivers flowing through it, surrounded by mountains. It sits about 3,500 metres high. It will be very cold right now, particularly at night. People will have no shelter.
What time of day was it when
the
quake actually struck? 8 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
So people will have been up. Some people will have been on their way to school, on their way to work.
Thank goodness children will have been in school, yes, and wouldn't have been in their beds.
Right, and as far as you know, that the schools were not among buildings that were affected?
They were. Our orphan school, I've just heard, the whole of the dormitory fell down. The school's now organising a camp. They have tents, so they're very, very lucky, because most people in the town won't have anywhere to stay
tonight. But the children in that building are OK, are they?
One teacher died.
Right.
Neighbours, we know of neighbours and relatives of the children who've died. One of our teachers died. We've just heard of 100 people in a nearby village where one of our former students live who've all died.
Is this an area where buildings would have been erected with earthquakes in mind?
I doubt it. I'd never heard of an earthquake there before. Apparently the last one I've just found out today was in 1975, but I'd never known of earthquakes in that area.
And what kind of building materials do they use? Are the buildings made of wood or of concrete?
Most of the housing that seems to have been mostly damaged is built from wood and adobe, mud and straw, but wooden structures, some with low walls, stone walls as well.
So the picture you've got then, from what you've been hearing over the last few hours, is of people very scared, very apprehensive, and a lot of them presumably now out in the open because they don't want to be inside a building.
They must be out in the open. They're expecting more aftershocks. So it's running away from the town is what we're hearing, out to a big grassland area where the famous Yushu Horse Festival takes place. That's what we're hearing, with the direction that people are going. There's particularly damage to one of the main monasteries just on the outskirts of the town. So people won't be able... roads are down. There is an airport nearby, and I read of an emergency service getting in, but the roads are all up and damaged. So how they're going to get to the town. They're desperate for tents, medicines and food.
Diana Dodd from the charity ROCPA. The United States has said it would be prepared to help the interim government of Kyrgyzstan a week after President Bakiyev fled the capital Bishkek. The US Assistant Secretary of State Robert Blake, who's in Kyrgyzstan in the wake of last week's events, said he felt optimistic about the steps the interim administration was already taking. Kyrgyzstan's interim leader, Rosa Otunbayeva, has said that if Mr. Bakiyev is caught, he should stand trial for his role in the bloodshed during the demonstrations that forced him out of office. Russia's also offered support to the interim authorities and has called on Mr. Bakiyev to step down immediately. The Russian President Dmitry Medvedev said he had other serious concerns.
We understand what a civil war in the current conditions means. If it starts, God forbid, this niche will be attractive to terrorists and extremists of all kinds, because it's during conflicts like this that the most favourable grounds for radicals are created. And then we may have in Kyrgyzstan the kind of Afghanistan that existed in the past.
Mr. Bakiyev has said he's prepared to leave Kyrgyzstan if his safety and that of his family are guaranteed. He's also called on the interim government to hold talks, but admitted that he's heard nothing so far.
So far they haven't contacted me, none of them. They are waiting, but what are they waiting for? Are they waiting for this protest mood and anger here in the south to explode? Why are they doing it?
Our correspondent Rayan Dmitri is in southern Kyrgyzstan in the town of Jalalabad. Supporters of the interim government were meant to be holding a rally there, but Mr. Bakiyev still enjoys a strong following. I asked her what's been happening there.
We've spent the whole morning in the square, central square in Jalalabad, and it is quite chaotic because we've been told that the supporters of the interim government were supposed to gather today here this morning, but then they were met by the supporters of the ousted president Kurmanbek Bakiyev. So what we've been witnessing in the last couple of hours is like two groups of large groups of people trying to push their way onto the stage. So far, the supporters of Mr. Bakiyev, who are mainly women in their 40s or 50s, and they're shouting Bakiyev, Bakiyev. They are on that square, middle of the square, expressing their loyalty and their support to the ousted president. So it is unclear what happens with the supporters of the interim government. Reportedly they're moving elsewhere and they want to hold their own protest elsewhere, not in the main square.
And what is Mr. Bakiyev himself holding out for? Does he want to actually return as president, or is he simply trying to negotiate now some kind of safe passage?
On Tuesday, he said clearly that he will be prepared to step down if certain conditions are met by the interim government. Well, the latest news is that Rosa Otunbayeva, she is heading the interim government here in Kyrgyzstan, emerging after talks with the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State. She said that no talks will be held and the interim government will not go for a dialogue and will not meet those conditions set by Mr. Bakiyev. Because what he asked for, first and foremost, is security for himself and his family. And Ms. Otunbayeva's response was that the list of those relatives for whom he wants that immunity is too big and they cannot guarantee that at this stage.
Rayan Dmitri. Divisions have emerged in Poland over a decision to bury President Lech Kaczynski in the Wawel Cathedral in Krakow, a place historically reserved for the nation's kings and heroes. Hundreds of people have already taken to the streets to protest. Adam Easton reports from Warsaw.
It was always going to be a controversial decision, even in the current atmosphere of a nation united in mourning. Now that unity has been broken. In a front-page commentary, Poland's leading daily Gazeta Wyborcza called it a hasty and emotional decision. An internet campaign has been launched and hundreds of people protested against it on the streets of Kraków on Tuesday night, some holding banners which said Mr. Kaczynski should not be buried alongside the nation's kings. Kraków's medieval Wawel Cathedral is a national shrine. Tourists flock to see its crypt, which holds the remains of saints, national heroes like Tadeusz Kościuszko and the father of Poland's modern independence, Marshal Piłsudski. Many believe Mr. Kaczynski should be buried alongside former presidents in Warsaw's cathedral or at the family grave in the city's Powązki cemetery.
Adam Easton in Warsaw. One of the leading figures in the Vatican has said that the cause of the child sex abuse scandal is not celibacy among the priesthood, but homosexuality. This is what Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone told a news conference in Chile.
Many psychologists, many psychiatrists have demonstrated that there is no relationship between celibacy and paedophilia. But many others have demonstrated, I was told recently, that there is a relationship between homosexuality and paedophilia. That is true. I have the documents of the psychologists. That's the problem.
Dan Damon spoke to Robert Mickens, the Vatican correspondent for the Tablet newspaper, and asked whether some people could find the tone of the Cardinal's comments slightly clumsy.
The Italian papers, of course, and papers in other parts of the world have expressed, surprise that he should say something which has been, by all accounts, proven false by the medical profession and psychiatrists. But from my point of view, as someone who covers and has covered the Vatican for a very long time, it's surprising because he's contradicted what Pope Benedict XVI himself has said on his visit to the United States in 2008. He told journalists on the plane that homosexuality and pedophilia were different things. And now his number two official, Cardinal Bertone, who I would just point out, has the role pretty much similar to the prime minister in a secular government, the Pope being the monarch. The prime minister, secretary of state, has come out and made these comments that apparently are in contradiction to what the Pope has said.
It's a sign that the Vatican feels under attack and that there is a campaign, and other senior officials have said this, there is a campaign to try and undermine the Pope.
They see this as a campaign to undermine the Pope, and they unfortunately do not have, I say unfortunately for them, they do not have an organized, coordinated strategy among the at the top and among the different branches of the Vatican. It's also very interesting because in many cases, the Vatican officials like to point out and insist that pedophilia is not something, it's something that's very minor in the priesthood, I mean, among priests, and it's more commonplace among families. Now, if you say that pedophilia is connected to homosexuality, it means that there are an awful lot of homosexual men that are married, according to their logic.
And anyway, he's obviously not read or has forgotten that he's read the Ryan report on what happened in Ireland, because there are plenty of girls giving evidence of abuse there. What is the next stage then? What do you think the Vatican is likely to do? Or is it simply digging the trenches and just trying to see its way through this without owning up too much?
Well, as one of my colleagues said yesterday at a press briefing, we should give them sharper shovels because they keep digging themselves deeper and deeper in this.
Robert Mickens, who's the Vatican correspondent for the Tablet newspaper. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Don't forget, if you want to comment on this podcast, all the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. Now, Britain's third party, the Liberal Democrats, have been setting out their plans for the country ahead of next month's general election. Their leader, Nick Clegg, sought to distance himself from the two leading parties, Labour and the Conservatives.
The two old parties, they've taught us to expect so little from politicians and get even less. They've taught us to expect that elections are 4 weeks of being fobbed off with promises you know will be broken, and in the end, you vote for the red team or the blue team, whichever one you dislike the least. Our manifesto says an emphatic no to that kind of politics.
So what sort of policies are the Liberal Democrats offering voters? I asked our political correspondent, Rob Watson.
What they're really offering is a pretty heavy government approach. They want government to be there to level the playing field in Britain so they would redistribute wealth from the richest in the country to the less well-off. They also want to concentrate on education. Don't all politicians say that, James? And also to reform Britain's political system to make it easier to sack your MP. That, of course, in the light of the MP's expenses scandal.
What about the economy? That has been the big issue so far. What are they going to do to try and sort out, for example, this big deficit that Britain has at the moment?
Well, they say that they're being far more straightforward than the other two parties, and they say they've laid out more detail about how you would reduce spending in some areas on the bureaucracy of government. Well, again, the other parties tend to say that as well, and that they would be willing to raise taxes on the better off.
Have they made much mention of the fact that, according to some observers at least, they could hold the balance of power if no one party emerges with an outright majority?
Well, I think you've hit on the most important thing there, that there is no doubt that the Liberal Democrats are hoping that this time round there will be a hung parliament for the first time in 30 years, and that absolutely, yes, they will be the kingmakers. And one of the lines that they've been trying with the voters is to say, look, given the tough times that are ahead, given these cuts that are going to happen in public spending, wouldn't it be better if it wasn't just left to one party, but perhaps to more than one party in some sort of a coalition or at least some kind of cooperation? So, yes, they think that's a selling point, and they can point to some of the opinion polls which suggest that quite a lot of British voters would themselves rather like this to be have an indecisive outcome.
Rob Watson. Zimbabwe's been through a period of political turmoil and sharp economic decline over the past few years. Some 4 million people have fled the country. That's around a third of the population. And the overwhelming majority of those who stayed no longer have formal employment. President Mugabe's critics blame the country's troubles on his controversial land reform program, forcibly removing white farmers and handing over land to black ownership, often with the violent support of veterans of the liberation struggle. But others regard the policy as that of righting the wrongs of Zimbabwe's colonial past. The BBC's Dan Isaacs has been travelling through Zimbabwe to see what price the people have paid for reform and to meet the new owners of the land.
This, for me, what I'm looking out at now is farmland as far as the eye can see in all directions. It used to be highly intensive, mechanised, farmed land. None of it now is being used. It's all turned back to grassland. And this farm here is owned by one of the most senior war veterans who I've come here to meet.
My name is Comrade Ndi Mhlanga. As war veterans, we are satisfied that the program of land reform succeeded. It might not be 100%, but we succeeded because the land is now with the people of Zimbabwe.
Even though senior war veterans like Ndi Mhlanga did well out of land reform, they haven't been able to cultivate the land as they want to. And they blame that on the lack of access to investment. So I wanted to find a farm where the new owners have been able to make a go of it, to use the land efficiently, despite the very real economic challenges they face. So I've come here to the farm run by Stan Kasakwere and his wife Jane. Stan is well connected. He has businesses in Harare and is the brother of a senior government minister. And he's been allocated a large farm on prime tobacco growing land.
Every farmer cherishes this farm when it's fully utilized, when you've done everything, when you've made use of any part of your land. As you can see, me and my wife, Jane, are so much involved with this farm.
The lunch table at Stan and Jane's farmhouse has been set out in the garden, in the shade of a spreading jacaranda tree.
You know, it's funny, they say Mugabe is always saying hateful things and all that. British is doing exactly the same, only in a very silent manner by doing these sanctions and all that. It's equally the same. Only Mugabe is being vocal about
actions
it.
Actions speak louder than
than words. He's being vocal about it. He's a frustrated man. Whereas for me, I didn't see the struggle. I'm just now enjoying what somebody fought for.
Well, I've come back now finally to end my journey in Harare, to track down one of those absent farm owners. Bright Mutunga is a former government minister and currently a ZANU-PF member of parliament.
Well, you've got to understand, it was a revolution, but now things have calmed down, production will pick up, and people have realised that the land reform is irreversible.
But what about, for example, the farm that you were allocated, Citrus Farm? There is no production, no cultivation going on there since the farm came into your hands. Why is that?
No, my farm is, I would say, nearly 100% utilised. Mm. I've utilised every piece of land on my farm. But you've got to understand these challenges on finance.
I'm slightly confused about that because I have seen, I've driven past kilometres of citrus tree plantation where the grass is as high as the trees. Now, that's not efficient use of the land.
Yeah, what you've got to understand, for effective production, you need capital. There is no capital, very minimum capital in the banks. But again, and I'm saying that things are, there is a great improvement because now the banks are now responding. They see that agriculture is the backbone of sustainable development in Zimbabwe.
Bright Mutunga is right. The backbone of Zimbabwe's economy is agriculture. But it has been broken by the land reform process. Some in Zimbabwe believe the costs have been worth it. Plenty more do not. And although Robert Mugabe, the 86-year-old veteran leader of Zimbabwe, has many political enemies, few have been able to effectively challenge him over land reform. To do so is to face being painted a colonial puppet and anti-black empowerment. So the land redistribution process is a done deal, and it's now up to the new owners of the land to learn to farm it well, for the sake of all Zimbabweans.
That report by Dan Isaacs, and you can hear more from Dan on this week's assignment programme on the BBC World Service. Scientists say they found clear evidence that meat from whales caught by Japan has been illegally sold in restaurants in the United States and Korea. The meat comes from at least one species feared to be in danger of extinction. Here's our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
There's been an international moratorium on commercial whaling since 1986, but a controversial exemption allows Japan to kill several hundred whales each year for what's termed scientific research. The meat from these whales is then sold to the public in shops and restaurants in that country. Now it appears that some of this meat is being illegally exported to Korea and the United States. A team of scientists, filmmakers and environmental advocates collected samples of whale meat being sold in sushi restaurants in both countries late last year. A genetic analysis of the meat found in Los Angeles showed that it was identical to meat from a sei whale being sold in Japan in 2007. This species is said to be in danger of extinction. Criminal proceedings have started against the Los Angeles restaurant caught selling the whale meat. It's now closed, but its owners face a year in prison and a substantial fine. The researchers involved say that trading in this meat is banned between countries that have signed the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. They argue that Japan should be required to make public a register of the DNA of all the whales it catches so that illegally traded meat can be tracked.
Matt McGrath reporting. Well, that's all from us for now. An updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download in 12 hours' time. I'm James Menendez. Until the next time, goodbye.